You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Where are we, Ian Boswell?
Well, Richard, I am at my friend Ansel Dickey's house, currently on a little quarantine. I just took, as we spoke when I was here last, I took a fishing trip out to Oregon. And to do that, I had to jump on an airplane for the first time since, goodness, I guess early March when I came back from Nice. So I'm at my friend Ansel's. He came out with me. Our partners are elsewhere, and we're here quarantining until our COVID tests return, which is taking longer than I had thought. But we're continuing the little bachelor adventure.
Well, we'll get back to that in a moment. But Lionel, you're also there as well. Hello, Lionel.
I am, Richard. Hello. Hello, Ian. Welcome back. Your COVID test results are going to take as long as or less time than the US presidential election result.
Than Pennsylvania.
Hopefully not as long as, but maybe everything will come all at once and I'll have a day of clarity and I'll know that my test came back negative and who is the next president of the United States.
Who would win a time trial up La Planche des Belles Filles, Joe Biden or Donald Trump?
Wow.
Well, that's in a honest and fair effort, I feel that Biden would win, but depends what sort of tactics are employed to get to the top.
Trump would probably dope massively for it and use an e-bike.
Steady on. We don't do politics.
This is a politics-free zone.
An actual genuine link between Donald Trump and professional cycling. I'm sure lots of people know this, Ian. I'm sure you know this, but the Tour de Trump in the 1990s was 80s, I think. 80s, yep, and yep. Early 90s.
I think it was early 90s. It was early 90s.
Yeah. It was America's biggest stage race at the time, the Tour de Trump.
Yeah, it was. I think it was either before or after the Tour de Trump. It was with the Tour de Pont, and then it changed names before my time as a racer, but I definitely have heard a lot about it. And yeah, I mean, I wish that there were more. Who knows? Maybe Trump will start a new bike race as a way to, you know, earn back some
reinvent exactly. Himself post-politics.
89 and 90, it was a Tour de Trump won by Dagoto Lauritsen and Raul Alcala. And then it became the Tour du Pont. Eric Brookink, Greg LeMond, Ekimov and Lance Armstrong were the winners of it before the race ended. But yeah, it was a big deal at the time. And who would have known then that Donald Trump would go on to be the president of the United States? Amazing, really.
Well, that's enough. I'm sure people want to hear about cycling, and we will get on to the Vuelta. We'll also ask Ian a little bit about the Giro, because you last joined us, Ian, when the Giro was still running, and there was that late twist, of course, you know Theo Gegenhardt very well. So we'll ask you to look back a bit on the Giro. It's great to have you back, though. You're one of our rotating presenters with Francois Thomazeau and Lizzie Banks, and you're with us for the final three nights of the Grandest Tour. We do want to ask you about your fishing trip as well, but what are the headlines from today, please, Lionel?
Well, stage 16 of the Vuelta from Salamanca to Ciudad Rodrigo, and it was a third stage win for EF Pro Cycling. Magnus Cort of Denmark won the sprint finish after wins for Mike Woods and Hugh Carthy earlier in the race for EF Pro Cycling. It was another kind of transitional day, wasn't it? A breakaway with Remy Cavagna of De Koenig Quickstep and Rob Stannard again, Mitchelton Scott, Kobe Goossens of Lotto Soudal, and then two BH Burgos riders, Angel Madrazo and Jesus Ezquerra. There was also another BH rider, Osorio, who was trying to get across but didn't manage to make it. And, the final part of the stage, a couple of climbs, Cavagna went clear of the rest and was joined by Rob Stannard, and they were looking pretty good. The gap did come right back down again, and then Cavagna was left out on his own, and it was a pursuit race between him and the peloton. Cavagna was finally caught 2.1 kilometers from the line. With about a kilometer to go, Groupama France's de jour rider Bruno Armerey tried his luck, but he was caught by the peloton as the sprint opened up and got it. But the most interesting thing as far as the GC battle goes is that Primoz Roglic was second, so he gets a 6-second time bonus, which could be absolutely crucial in tomorrow's mountaintop finish stage. Third today was Dion Smith of Mitchelton Scott, then Alejandro Valverde, and then Richard Carapaz, but he of course outside the time bonuses. So the GC going into that final decisive stage, Primoz Roglic is now 45 seconds ahead of Carapaz, and Hugh Carthy is at 53 seconds. The women's race, the three-day Serra Tizit Challenge by La Vuelta. First stage won by Lorena Vibus of Sunweb. A sprint ahead of Elisa Balsamo and Lisa Brennauer. Britain's Alice Barnes was in fifth place. Tomorrow there's a 9.3-kilometre time trial, and then on Sunday, a flat 100-kilometre race around Madrid.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iWalker.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
I'm Will. I'm the head of engineering at iWalker. I've been here for 5 years. I'm responsible mainly for the back end of our systems. With a product like iWalker's, most of our tech is actually about the delivery of the product. So we do all the work to make sure that all of the application process is as smooth as possible. All of the customer funds go where they need to. And also making sure that the experience of anyone calling our customer success team is as smooth and helpful as possible. Our dream situation is that someone can land on our website and within 5 or 10 minutes not only get approved for a loan, but actually have the funds in their bank account. And then obviously, you know, if that's not possible, help the team of people who are behind the website to make sure that we answer any questions and queries that people might have.
Now, Richard, a corrections corner. In the iWalker slots the last couple of nights, I've been talking about their London to Brighton bike ride, and I've been saying that they've been tackling Ivinghoe Beacon. Of course, I mean Ditchling Beacon. Ivinghoe Beacon is a local climb to me, quite well known to anyone who rides in the Chilterns, but not a feature in the 1994 Tour de France. And it's not on the way to Brighton, Ivinghoe Beacon.
Only in your dreams, Lionel, or in your own fantasy Tour
well,
de France.
Yeah, sorry about that. I mean, obviously, the brain's getting a bit tired at the end of the Grandest Tour. I've just got a bit of a blind spot there. I just said Ivinghoe Beacon when I'm in
London
Ditchling
to Brighton
Beacon.
Via Watford would make an even bigger day out, wouldn't it?
It would indeed. Wow, what an event. Maybe that could be a pro race.
It sounds like it. Well, speaking of pro racing, well-known hotel reviewer Magnus Cort was the winner today. If you're not familiar with his hotel reviews, go to his Instagram account. He gives fantastically detailed reviews of every hotel he stays in, and a score out of 7. And they're very quirky and quite good fun. And it all started because Astana, his previous team, were trying to encourage him to have a bit more of a social media presence. And he didn't really want to put himself out there. So he decided to start reviewing his hotels. So that's quite entertaining. But a good win by him. And for a little bit, I thought Alejandro Valverde might win. He is our good friend Moyin Islam on our Facebook page wrote today that Valverde has not had a win this year, which is astonishing, really. And Movistar did an awful lot of work to try and set him up. He faded in the end. He went a little bit too early and couldn't quite sustain it. It was quite a messy sprint, really. He finished fourth, but he actually sat up. And you know, if Roglic wins the wins the Vuelta by 1 or 2 or 3 seconds, he may well have Movistar and Valverde to thank for that. because he did get that time bonus today. It was Magnus Cort as well, I thought, was in the wind quite a lot. He came from quite a long way and had to do a lot to get that win. He also impeded Roglic a little bit. Roglic's sprint was interrupted, and Roglic was pretty annoyed, I think, on the line not to have won the stage. So, you know, he's just a machine, isn't he, Roglic? And it was, a real boost for him going into tomorrow's crucial stage.
Well, I did watch today's stage, Richard. It's actually the first stage of the Vuelta I've watched since I left for my trip. I've been following along, and it seems like there's been quite a few riders at this race who have really made a name for themselves. And it's interesting to see racing happening so late in the year. And I know that the Magnus Cort, he did win a race early in the season, but it's been, looking at the Vuelta and then now the Giro, now the Vuelta, EF has had a pretty good streak of wins over the last couple of weeks, which is good to see for, you know, myself being an American and kind of the American team out there. And it's been awesome to see kind of some, I don't say fresh faces, because Magnus has had some big wins before. I think he won a stage in the Tour in 2018. But it's been stages like today, while maybe not the most exciting, a sprint like that when there's not a real clear, you know, lead out train, it's always fun to watch.
Yeah, he won the stage into Carcassonne, Richard, if you remember, in 2018 in the Tour de France, when he was riding for Astana and he was in the break with Michael Valgren, and they really worked it pretty well, didn't they? But then it came down to a sort of sprint between Magnus Cort, Jon Izagirre and Bauke Mollema. And he's had some success in the Vuelta in the past as well. Two stage wins very late on, including the final one into Madrid in 2016. So, racking up another win for EF Pro Cycling. And
But Lionel, can I just sort of take you back to that day into Carcassonne? Who was 87th on that stage?
I think I was, Richard.
Could be. Do you know all your placings off by heart?
No, but I figured I was at that race, and I remember that stage. It was extremely hot, which they have not had.
Tell you what, Ian, I met you. This is no joke. I met you that morning on your way to the start, and you were riding past on your way to sign on. A lot of riders were warming up, and you said, "Why is everyone warming up? That's worrying because I'm supposed to get in the break today." I remember that quite vividly.
I do remember that. Yeah, there was a down from the team bus. I think we had showed up late, and it was like a downhill kind of to the start finish. Huh? I remember that clearly. I think we didn't warm up also because I think Igor Makarov had showed up that day, probably to enjoy some delicious food down that way. And I actually had snuck my friend onto the team bus when Makarov came on. And yeah, I had to quickly sneak my friend Marshall off of the bus because I was like, oh no, like he shouldn't be on here. And I'm not sure how many teammates we had at that point, but we could have already been down to four riders at that point. So there was extra seating on the bus.
I remember it very clearly. Yeah, I remember your bus was parked right at the end of all the buses because you'd arrived late and you'd been given the job to try and get in the break. And you were kind of worried at the fact that you didn't have time to warm up and everybody else was on turbos. Anyway, that just came into my head.
Well, I mean, I was going to say something, Richard. You said that, I mean, I was impressed that Roglic finished second, but at the same time, Carapaz was fifth. So which is, you know, it's not a pure sprint, but there are some quick guys in that group, showing that both Carapaz and Roglic are kind of fiercely contesting, you know, the overall win. And at the same time, maybe 4 or 5K to go, I saw that Hugh Carthy, who's, you know, up there on the podium at the moment, was surfing the back like a true old school GC rider. That's where I would have been. That's why I finished 78th on that day, just surfing the back as we roll in.
It's true. Yeah. Carthy was 27th across the line and he was a bit further back. I mean, Magnus Cort, he had been trying to look after him a bit. Mike Woods had punctured, so he was off the back. So Magnus Cort had quite an important job to do looking after Hugh Carthy. And, I think he did that until the finale when he was able to have a go. And he's a good, you know, he's got a good sprint. He's won quite big. It's actually his third stage win at the Vuelta. He won quite a big sprint at the Vuelta a couple of years ago. He's almost a sprinter, in fact, and it was a pretty small group. So, yeah, really good win. And, you know, they are having a fantastic season, EF. When you think about a couple of years ago, you know, they went almost 3 years, I think, without a win at all. And they've had a lot of wins this season.
Yeah.
Yeah, big ones as well. I mean, you know, won a stage in the Tour, a couple of stages in the Giro, and now three stages in the Vuelta. It's a, it's a big difference to that horrendous run they had where they really couldn't buy a World Tour win, could they?
Yeah, I remember speaking to Dombrowski. I think he was on the team at the time, and there was a lot of pressure on the team to get that, you know, first World Tour win in several years. And this year they've, I don't know the total number of World Tour wins they've had, but I mean, I'd have to say at least six or seven big, pretty big wins. You know, Michael Woods came close the other day, and yeah, it's, you know, sometimes a little bit, you know, oftentimes you see one rider on a team win and then, you know, it just keeps rolling. And I'm kind of wondering today, seeing Cavagna off the front. I mean, I'm always impressed at how successful the entire Quickstep team is. I mean, obviously they have talented riders, but just continually the team is putting themselves in a position to win stages. And it's, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things I was thinking, I wonder what that is. Why is, you know, Quickstep up there? Is it equipment? Is it talent? But you kind of look around the, you know, the Peloton, and there are other teams on similar equipment, and riders, you know, come to that team and go, but continually a team like Quickstep is up there. And, you know, at the moment, same with EF.
Well, Patrick Lefebvre has talked about this because he's, you know, he has made it fairly clear that they go into every single race with a plan to try and win, whether that's getting somebody off the front or bringing it back together for a sprint. They even on days when perhaps the odds are against them, they do get people in breaks. And I mean, it's a way to play the percentages, isn't it? If you can have a plan every single day. And I don't think that every team necessarily has that. I mean, some teams do seem to drift through the whole week of a Grand Tour without having really participated in breaks, or, you know, had much success in sprints. Presumably it is a sort of cultural thing as well. I mean, they don't tolerate failure. I mean, they had this very fantastic run of wins. I mean, you know, winning sort of in the 70s and 80s season after season. And, you know, that's become almost expected.
And yet they're stuck on 99 Grand Tour stage wins at the moment. Sam Bennett obviously was relegated a few days ago. That would have been the 100th, and they are kind of stuck. And well, Cavagna had a really good go today. Catania yesterday had a really good go as well to get that 100th stage win, which would probably mean a lot. And they haven't got many chances left, although Sunday should be a decent chance for Sam Bennett again, shouldn't it? It's interesting on
think,
that point.
Do you think the rider that gets the 100th Grand Tour win will get, I don't know, a free week shopping in Lidl, or maybe their whole new set of
windows
for their home from De Koenig? Yeah, I don't know.
And some nice bonus. Quick step flooring. Yeah, who knows? But just on that subject of teams and momentum, I did ask Mark Donovan, the Sunweb rider, the other day about that, because his team has been on a real roll as well. Although they've fallen a bit short of the Vuelta, but I asked what the secret was, and he said there isn't any. We don't really do anything special. It's just if a team starts winning, it's much easier to carry on winning. You know, it's a bit of a cliche, but it kind of backs up what you were saying a bit, Ian.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And the same time with when teams, you know, are on the other end of the spectrum and they're not winning, it's really hard to kind of come out of that bubble of not winning. And, you know, you see that, you know, you've seen that with EF. I guess kind of my last 2 years at Katusha, we kind of were in a similar situation where we just couldn't win. And it's, you know, you were saying how Lefebvre makes a plan every day of how can we win the stage. I clearly remember in the Vuelta in 2018, Dmitry Konachev, who I really enjoyed having as a director because he was sometimes blatantly, you know, realistic. You know, I remember him on a stage saying, "Hey guys, like, don't do anything today." Like a couple guys, like, "Hey, can I go in the breakaway?" He's like, "Oh, you're not strong enough to go in the breakaway." "Hey, can I sprint?" "Well, you're not going to win the sprint." And it was the complete opposite mentality, maybe, you know, a little bit of a Russian mentality, but, you know, kind of save your eggs for another day because, you know, we probably weren't going to do anything. But it just, you know, if you put yourself out there, the odds of something happening, you know, can happen. It's kind of back to, you know, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
And also, do you learn something from doing that? I mean, sitting in the bunch, would you learn more from, you know, going out in the break? I mean, I remember being struck at the Vuelta, was it a couple of years ago, when Richie Porte went in a three-man break on a flat stage, and afterwards he was talking about how much of an appreciation he got for what he called a different type of cycling, not something that he would ever normally do. And he sort of had almost a sense of respect for what the guys who go in the breakaway actually have to go through.
Hi everyone, it's Scott Davis from Team Bahrain McLaren checking in after stage 16 of the Vuelta España. Just go back to stage 15 quickly, which was yesterday's stage. A long day in the saddle, 230 kilometres, and I'm block headwind all day, so it proved to be a really, really long, challenging day in the saddle. And the weather took a bit of a turn towards the end. But fortunately for us, we had a great result with young Fred Wright taking fourth place on the stage. So that was a superb ride by him. And yeah, bodes really well for the future. And then, yeah, today, stage 16, was a bit stressful at the start. Weather forecast was for a lot of wind and crosswind at that. So obviously every team gets the same information, or very similar. So the first 20Ks were, yeah, pretty full on, but in the end it turned out to be all right. And then as the stage went on, all the GC contenders sort of took up the race, and in the end came down to a reduced bunch sprint, and we had Wout Poels in there looking after himself, and he even finished 12th in the sprint, so a really good effort by him too. So yeah, we're towards the end of the race now. It's not done by a long shot, but one more big day tomorrow. We're all in for Wout, like I said in my previous update. And then, yeah, hopefully we all get to Madrid and defend Wout's place on GC, or even better it. Anyway, thanks a lot, guys. Speak to you soon.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
Well, that was Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by our friends at Beer 52. And if you'd like to see what Beer 52 have to offer, go to beer52.com/cycle, and if you cover the £5.95 postage charge, they'll deliver an exclusive case of a selection of beers worth £24 right to your door. Now, I've just poured myself a glass from the most recent collection. Each month has a different theme, and the most recent box that I received was on the theme of the Oktoberfest, the famous beer festival in Germany. And this is called Fest Beer, and well, it's a lager, but for a lager, it's got a really nice amber colour, and it's quite a full-bodied lager, so it's not sort of weak and wibbly. Yeah, a very nice glass to toast the coming end of the Vuelta with. Perhaps not the most appropriate beer to pair with the Vuelta. It's not Spanish, it's not Slovenian, it's not Ecuadorian, it's not from Preston, but it is very tasty. Now, if you want to sign up for Beer 52, you can do so, as I said, at beer52.com/cycle. That's beer52.com/cycle. There's no minimum commitment. You can just take a free case of beers, try the selection that you get sent, and if it's not for you, you can pause and cancel at any time. But what I like about it is the variety. You never quite know what you're going to get.
Well, the race is still pretty well poised for tomorrow's very important penultimate stage, with that summit finish at Alto de la Covatilla, where Ben King won a couple of years ago on his own. It saw a replay of that today, and it was reminded how tough a climb it is. Very, very steep in places. A headwind I've seen forecast for the climb, which could affect things a little bit and make it less, you know, favourable to attackers and sort of nullify things a little bit potentially. But, you know, I think we saw today, didn't we, how strong how strong Roglic is. And, you know, maybe it was a statement that I was speculating after the time trial that Roglic wasn't at his absolute best in that time trial, and maybe his powers would wane over this week. That didn't seem the case today. I mean, George Bennett tried to lead him out. He was up for trying to win the stage, and he's taken a real bonus of a few seconds there. And it's kind of difficult to imagine him losing the sort of time that he would need to lose in order for Carapaz or Hugh Carthy to leapfrog him. I don't know. Can you see anything surprising happening tomorrow, Ian, or do you think that Roglic is very much in the driving seat?
I mean, he's looking incredibly strong with one day, well, one GC day to go, and I guess we probably said the same thing, you know, going into stage 20 of the Tour de France, which, you know, he completely kind of, you know, things went upside down and he wound up losing the yellow jersey. But, you know, given that it's a mass start race, it's not a time trial, you know, the, like you said, that climb up to Covatia, it was done in 2018 last. And it is a very open and exposed climb. I mean, I was at that race in 2018, and, you know, if it's windy up there, that could really, like you said, nullify the race. And just with the riders around Roglic, I think that, you know, it's going to be really hard to, you know, try to make something happen. But that said, you know, the course is challenging, and, you know, we've seen Ineos Grenadiers be pretty, you know, racing aggressively, and, you know, they really have nothing to lose by trying to, you know, implement some sort of tactic ahead of the final climb and maybe try and isolate Roglic, or maybe try to do something from the bottom of the climb. And, you know, we've had so far this year two amazing finishes to two Grand Tours, and, you know, why not have a third time's a charm, right?
You have to think, though, that the numbers game really favours Roglic, not just in the time gap he's got over the other two, but also that he isn't going to be isolated if his team, unless his team absolutely collapses around him, and that would require three or four riders to you know, have an absolute shocker all on the same day. He's going to have most likely Sepp Kuss side by side or just in front of him all the way up that climb if he needs him, and so he doesn't necessarily, even if things aren't panning out perfectly in terms of, you know, trying to win the stage and do it in style, you'd have to think it would, I mean, what is it now, did I say 45 seconds, sorry, to Carapaz? That's quite a big gap, even on a climb that is difficult. And if it, as you say, if it's headwind, I mean, it's much harder for the rider out in front on a headwind climb, isn't it, than those behind, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. And I, you know, I was away on a fishing trip, so I haven't been following the Vuelta as closely as I'd followed the Giro and the Tour. So I don't know what sort of time gaps have been, you know, kind of seen on mountaintop finishes. And it's kind of a trend over the last few years that, you know, very few, you know, mass start races and mountaintop finishes really see huge time chunks, either gain or loss. It's something you just don't see anymore. I mean, the last couple Grand Tours have been decided by an individual time trial late in the race. So yeah, I would say odds are on Roglic to take his second Vuelta.
I mean, I'm clutching at straws a little bit here, Ian. And I agree that there haven't been big time gaps, but at the Angliru and at the Col de la Loz, which I think have been the two hardest summit finishes that Roglic has tackled this year, he has lost time on both of those. Okay, he actually gained time to Pogacar at the Tour, but lost a bit to Lopez. And you know, he couldn't go with him, and he couldn't go with Hugh Carthy or Carapaz on the Angliru. He didn't lose much, but, you know, it's a point I was making the other night in the podcast that he can have all the teammates around him. He can have six teammates around him. They can only go as fast as he can go on a climb like that. The Covatia is not as hard as that. You know, it's sort of 9.1% at the steepest part, or it's 10.5% a bit further down. But towards the top, there's a kilometre that's 9.1%. It's not as super steep as Col de la Loz or Angliru. And that's where Roglic has kind of cracked a little. So I'm not optimistic that we're going to see a huge shake-up at all, but there's still just a tiny glimmer of a possibility.
Yeah, well, I mean, and, you know, there's two sides of cycling. You know, there is the physical and there's also the mental. And I wonder, you know, if Roglic, you know, going to bed tonight is going to have any sort of thought of, you know, I was in the same position, you know, a month and a half ago at the Tour de France, and, you know, I lost it, and, you know, 2 years ago at the Giro, and, you know, if there's any sort of, you know, I think we, you know, see this once in a while with, well, we've seen it a lot with Thibaut Pinot, where he's been in a really good position, and then it comes down to, you know, the final few days of a Grand Tour, the final week, and he's, you know, dropped out of the race or crashed out or, you know, completely dropped out of the classification. And, you know, it's almost, I wouldn't say it's expected of Pinot now, but, you know, a lot of riders within the bunch kind of look at that and like, well, he's going to have a bad day. And Roglic has proved that he, you know, he can win a Grand Tour. He did it last year at the Vuelta. But I just wonder now internally what sort of pressure he's feeling and putting on himself tonight going into a stage like tomorrow, knowing that it's his race to lose now. And, you know, what sort of kind of, you know, stress can that add to the stage tomorrow for him and for his team?
In terms of the tactics, I mean, I don't like to sort of speculate and guess what might be going through the minds of the three riders. But I think that the one thing that might be in Richard Carapaz's favour is that he's got Hugh Carthy just on his shoulder. And it isn't just Carapaz that Roglic has to keep an eye on. Carthy's position on the podium is reasonably secure. He's got almost a minute over Dan Martin. He might fancy trying to make up those few seconds on Carapaz and move up to second, or he might fancy another stage win and might be prepared to, you know, put everything he's got on the table in order to do either of those two things, which might then tease out Carapaz, and then suddenly it's sort of two riders that Roglic has got to chase, and there's no longer any, you know, well, after you close this one down, and then, well, who knows? I mean, it's not just a straightforward head-to-head dynamic. It might actually be a proper three-way fight. We might see some real fireworks, but, well, we'll find out tomorrow afternoon.
Well, and if Hugh Carthy did win, if Hugh won the Vuelta, when was the last time that there were three first-time Grand Tour winners in the same season?
I think it was a couple of years ago, was it not? When Simon Yates, Geraint Thomas, and who won the Giro that year?
No,
Froome won the Tour of the Giro in 2018.
So it wasn't then.
You're right. So he wasn't a first-time Grand Tour winner. That's right. Can I ask you a question, Ian?
Please.
Somebody on Twitter, David Russell, asked me a few days ago. He said, on the pod, it's mentioned how many support riders Rog has, which I sort of understand, but why can't Carapaz just sit on Rog's wheel like Pog did in the Tour de France? Or are there tactics I don't understand? Not a cycling nerd, he says in brackets. Can't ride myself. So that's David Russell's question. And it's a good question. I mean, you know, the tactic that Jumbo Visma used at the Tour was to ride in that sort of train formation that we saw Sky do many times, but Pog was the stone in the shoe that they couldn't get rid of. And it's a good question. The logic behind that tactic of riding in the way that we saw Jumbo Visma ride at the Tour and a lot of the time here as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, even in today's stage, there was a point when we saw Froome on the front and we saw Ineos kind of pushing the pace, and I was, you know, but then they didn't try anything later on, which is a bit of a surprise. And I think it really comes down to, you know, kind of team pride, but also horsepower, you know. And I found this a lot when I was at Team Sky, that, you know, we would ride on the front, not necessarily for a reason, but because we could, and we had the horsepower. So it's like, all right, let's use the horsepower we have, and maybe to no avail, but you do it because you can. And I think it's, you know, very much kind of maybe psychologically, you feel like you're in control when you're on the front. And so you see Ineos, you know, putting, that's just the way that the team has been riding. That's the way that the team probably will continue to ride, but they don't necessarily need to ride in that way. And I think it's really hard for a team, you know, to go into a team meeting and say, hey, we're going to follow Roglic today. Carapaz, you sit on his wheel, everyone else sit behind, and, you know, we'll see what happens in the final, and we can maybe try something then. But there's also, you know, there's an internal conversation there's an internal conversation that every rider has is, you know, if you're a teammate and that's the case where you're just going to follow, you know, you really didn't do much that day. And I think riders, you know, and myself, you know, I always wanted to be a part of something and do something. So if that means riding on the front, you know, you get on the team bus at the end of the stage and you can say, hey, I did something. I didn't just follow, you know, I didn't just follow all day.
I think that the control is the key word there, isn't it? And George Bennett in the podcast the other day did say that they didn't intend to ride the Vuelta like this, and they haven't to the same extent that they did at the Tour, but they have taken on quite a lot of days just because no other team has been willing to do so. And you do need a team to sit on the front and control things, or it just becomes very chaotic and uncontrollable. So it is just a way of exerting control as well.
I can answer Ian's question. When was the last year that all three Grand Tours were won by first-time Grand Tour champions? It wasn't 2018, it was 2019. Carapaz, Bernal, Roglic. So, I mean, it could be the first time it's ever happened since last year.
Wow, a whole 12 months.
Easily overlooked, though, that, yeah.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
A big thank you to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. Very, very grateful to them indeed. And if you want 25% off all your Science and Sport sports nutrition products, go to scienceandsport.com, enter the code SISCP25, SISCP25. Now, there's been some good news in Spain. It was released on the rest day this week. They will have a new professional continental team, or pro team as they're now known, in 2021. Equipo Kern Pharma have grown out of the Lizarte team. And somebody who's been very involved in that team and who will be very involved in the new pro Conti team is our old friend Fran Reyes, who's been part of our Vuelta coverage in the past. Fran's going to be, as I say, very involved with the new Pro Conti team, and it's very good news for Spanish cycling. So I caught up with him on the rest day. Well, Fran, I mean, you're well known to our listeners, and you've been involved for a number of years with Lizarte, the team, where Richard Carapaz came through that team, Marc Soler as well. They came through that team, but tell me about the new setup, Equipo Kern Pharma. To become a UCI pro team. That's pro continental team in 2021.
Well, Richard, it's great talking to you. It's great also to be able to say hi to our listeners after pretty much 2 years, maybe 1 year since last time we spoke for the podcast. So, yeah.
Hello great from listeners. Fran.
It's great. Hello. And yeah, well, Kern Pharma, as you said in your introduction, I've been working with Lizarte for 5 years already. This is a team that has quite some tradition in Spain. It was first founded in 1993, and since 3-4 years ago, we began to search for sponsorship to create a professional team, because we saw that even if some talents manage to reach the top, the elite of the sport, as Carapaz, Soler, Oscar Rodriguez, there were some others that couldn't quite make it. You know, maybe they turned up pro, but after 2 years, they couldn't develop, or they just call it quits. And we wanted to, you know, support the riders also to become pro. And luckily, we found Kern Pharma, which is a pharmaceutical company here in Spain, who were interested on such a project as the one we were offering. And yeah.
It's great news, and it's great news for Spanish cycling, I guess, as well. You've got one World Tour team now, Movistar, of course, but a new Pro Conti team is a real boost, isn't it, for Spanish professional cycling?
Yeah. You know, for years, I mean, at the beginning of this century, I remember back when I was a child, there were 5, 6, 7 Spanish professional teams, you know, and there was even a moment on which Spain was on its economic best. And we had 4 pro tour teams and 5 professional teams. Mm-hmm. But those times were quite gone, you know, and for several seasons there only was 1 World Tour team and 1 professional team, Movistar team and Caja Rural. And that was quite sad, because a lot of talents were lost in that way. You know, there have been, you know, dozens of professional riders that couldn't find a chance to become more of what they were, and that had to quit cycling out of not having where to ride, you know, what team to ride for. Luckily, these past 3-4 years, we have seen Burgos BH step up to become a pro team. We have seen how Euskaltel, well, Fundación Euskadi, had stepped up too, thanks to Mikel Landa and the efforts that they have put together with Orbea and Euskaltel. Now, Alberto Contador, his team, that has been a county team for several years, is now turning up pro team also next year, although I think with an Italian license, because they got a new Italian sponsor, Eolo. And now there's us that have also thrived during these last 2-3 years. So it's quite a beautiful landscape now, you know, because there will be 4 Spanish pro teams plus Eolo Cometa. And that would grant quite an interesting fight in every Spanish race, and especially when it comes to fighting for the wildcards for La Vuelta.
Well, that will be the big aim of every team, isn't it? How realistic are you about getting to the Vuelta next year?
Well, for us, what the goal we are setting to ourselves is that we want to prove in 2021 that we are worth a wildcard. We know that it is very difficult to get in there in the first year. As things stand, as the rules stand, there are only 2 wildcards in possession of La Vuelta. And in 2021, the race starts from Burgos. So it's only normal that Burgos BH is going to get one of them. That leaves 1 spot open. And with the tradition of Caja Rural, the tradition of Euskaltel, we obviously have to... work a lot to prove that we are worth an invitation. If we are not, if we don't get it in 2021, we will try to get it in 2022, and whatever. We are going to do our best, grow along with our riders, try to, you know, put in evidence some exciting young talents that we have in our team, and try to make the best case possible to get an invitation, be it next year, the following, or the other.
Well, that was Fran Reyes on the new Equipo Kern Pharma, who will appear in the Peloton in 2021 and be battling for a wildcard spot at the Vuelta. They've got a 2-year agreement with Kern Pharma, but it is, he stressed, a long-term project. So the fact it's grown out of an existing team that's been around for a long time is perhaps good for its long-term sustainability. It's got long roots in Spanish cycling. Just as we said earlier on, Ian, we had you last on the podcast while the Giro was still going on, and there were those late twists and turns. I'm sure you followed that with interest. But before we get on to that, did you catch many fish?
We did do some good fish catching. Yeah, we were over in Eastern Oregon, started off on the Wallowa and then down the Grand Ronde River, where my brother's a fly fishing guide, so he knows all the honey holes to put the flies. And yeah, wow. caught a coho salmon, a couple steelhead, rainbow trout, and a couple bull trout and whitefish. So yeah, it was a fantastic trip, and I think probably the best part about it, besides catching fish, was the fact that there's no cell phone service for the entirety of the trip. So it was 7 days of literally you couldn't, it's not even like you put your phone away. It's like you couldn't, you know, there's no point of even having your phone on because you can't catch any Wi-Fi, you can only catch fish. So it was, it's crazy in this day and age that you can still find places where you get no service, and to kind of fly back and re-immerse to the election was quite the surprise.
Were you in your waders standing in the middle of the river casting away? I mean, is that how you were doing it?
Yeah, we did fish from like the shore in waders, but we floated down the river, so it was a point to point trip. I think it was 45 river miles, and you know, thankfully my brother knows this river and he's, you know, an expert rower, so he could kind of just plop us, you know, as close as possible to where, you know, the fish wouldn't be scared, and we could, you know, where I could actually reach my fly rod to and cast out there. So it made it a lot easier. You know, it wasn't like you kind of do loops and just keep passing the same hole where the steelhead were stacked up. And yeah, it's I've definitely become a little bit of spending so much time, I've become an expert in cycling, and to see my brother become an expert of fly fishing is I'm really impressed with, you know, just how much he knows in that world.
Great. And what, camping on the shore every night?
Yep, camping on the shore. He has a very Lionel, you should sign up for one of these trips. We ate like kings as well. We had fantastic food. I mean, we were eating, you know, delicious meals every day. And yeah, camping on the shore, we had a big wall tent with us, a big canvas tent, so you could sleep inside or sleep outside depending on your preference. Yeah, we had a wood stove out there and multiple, you know, burners for cooking, and played a big game of baseball on the beach at one point, and that's probably what caused a lot of soreness in my body, was doing a sport that is foreign to me, swinging a bat trying to hit pine cones.
Oh, sounds fantastic.
Oh, I'm very envious. But Ian, I'm sure you also had half an eye on the Giro. You know, you were part of our coverage there. And what did you make of those final couple of stages, and the way that Theo Gegenhardt was able to, you know, he was outside the top 10 maybe when you were last on the podcast, but it was a late charge and quite a remarkable one. We went straight into the Vuelta, so we didn't really have time. We haven't really had time to digest it properly. But what did you make of it all?
I mean, I don't want to say I was blown away, because, you know, Theo rode in such a, you know, kind of dominating style. But I can't believe that he won the Vuelta. You know, he's still such a young rider, and, you know, I think I've you know, I've known Theo for a long time. He was at Action after me, so we kind of already had a connection, you know, he came up through that team. And, you know, even when I was at Sky and he was still there, you know, we'd chatted to our California, and eventually he came to Sky, and you know, so I got to know him pretty well. We still stay in touch. I told both of you, he was messaging me as he was probably warming up for the time trial. I don't know why, but and he's a rider that over the course of his career has, you know, internally with teams been very confident, and sometimes with, you know, different riders, especially senior riders, I feel like there's kind of been a sense like, hey, like this Theo guy, I don't say has a big head on his shoulders, but he's very confident, and he knew what he wanted to do. He knew what he was capable of. And I think early on in his career that people were sometimes a bit, you know, standoffish to that, like, well, this, like, you kind of have to earn your stripes here. But it's awesome to see that internally he knew what he was capable of. He knew his goals. He knew, you know, his talent, and that, you know, no one can question, you know, that, you know, level of confidence now, because he's a Grand Tour winner. My question for you two is, how will the 2020 Giro be viewed in history of cycling? I mean, not to take away from Theo at all, but, you know, the fact that, you know, two kind of marquee teams pulled out, the fact that the tour teams were so stacked, and, you know, a lot of, you know, outside of Geraint Thomas and a few other GC contenders, you know, Kruijswijk, you know, how do you think the history will view the 2020, I guess, Giro and potentially Vuelta, just because...
I think that's a great question, and I do think it owes a lot to what Theo in particular, but also Jai Hindley, what they go on to do. You know, if they go on to become you know, serial Grand Tour contenders or winners, then there won't be any kind of, not asterisk, but you know, even question about the status of the event. It's almost you know, the status of the event is conferred by the quality of the rider, in a way, isn't it? And I think, you know, they're both at the start of their careers, and if they back that up, then I don't think anybody will talk about the Giro in the 2020 Giro as being any different to any other Giro, apart from it being at a different time of year. If they don't, if neither of them ever gets close to winning another Grand Tour, then I think we'll look on it as being anomalous and a bit different, and almost more interesting for that, actually. But I do think I do think what they go on to do is very important in determining how we look at this Giro in the future.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, Rich. But then I'm looking at the sort of previous winners, and you look back at, say, Ryder Heyerdahl in 2012, which was probably the last kind of surprise, real surprise. I mean, all right, Richard Carapaz was a surprise last year, but he's then kind of backed that up this year by contending in the Vuelta, and so that already is sort of propping up and strengthening
Carapaz's. It elevates that race, doesn't it?
It does, it absolutely. If Carapaz had, even the way he rode at the Tour, was strengthening what that Giro win was all about for Carapaz. I suppose when you look back over the last decade or so, it is that win by Heyerdahl, and you look back and think, who did he beat? Well, he beat Joaquim Rodriguez, and that's the one that stands out as a sort of that's a curious one. And yet at the time that was a real ding-dong battle between those two riders, wasn't it? And but I don't think anyone at that time was thinking, oh well, now Heyerdahl is going to go on and win a Tour de France or even necessarily podium a Grand Tour again. It was his status, he didn't suddenly sort of rocket three, four rungs up the up the list of GC contenders, whereas both Gegenhart and Hindley are young and have a lot of time in front of them. And I think that probably there'll be sort of some ups and downs. There'll be a period where they're perhaps in the lower half of the top 10 or outside the top 10 and don't back up immediately, but they have time on their side. And I certainly think I'm a big believer that you can only beat who's in front of you, and that's you can only beat the people who are in the race. And so I wouldn't say
they tend to be behind you when you beat them.
Well, if they're in front of you, you've definitely got to beat them, otherwise you're not going to win, are you?
I was going to turn the question back at you, Ian. I mean, Ian, you mentioned earlier the time of year that it is and how that might be playing tricks on some riders' bodies, perhaps. Who knows, their kind of internal clock will be all askew. But how do you think, do you think that the timing of the Giro, both timing in the calendar year and it being so close to the Tour, do you think we'll look back on it as a slightly different, as a Giro that kind of stands apart from other Giri?
Well, I hadn't really considered what the two of you had said, where really I think time will tell. But that said, when you look at, I do believe that they did set the quickest time up to Stelvio. So it's not like the performances were subpar performances. So I think when you look at it in that regard, that, it was, Teo won the race, he won the Giro, he has a pink jersey. And that at the end of the day, bike racing is bike racing. You could make a million excuses. Why was I 78th on that stage into Carcassonne? Well, I don't know. I could make an excuse for something. I wasn't in the breakaway.
I can't let this go, Ian, because it's the second time you've exaggerated your placing that day. You were actually 87th, not 78th.
Oh, geez, 87th. Okay. but I do think kind of would agree that time will tell. And I also have to think really the team that you're on probably also depends on kind of the status of your victory. When Heyerdahl won, he was with he was with like the early days of the, Slipstream organization, and they, that was a huge win for them. And for, for Ineos to win another Giro, while it's fantastic, they've won, seven Tour de France's now. And so it's how the kind of the result is viewed almost from the team's expectations, and kind of the team's results probably also play a bit of a factor.
I mean, one of the fascinating things about cycling is, how would Teo Gegenhart have got on at the Tour de France? How would he have got on if he was riding the Vuelta now? How would Hugh Carthy, in the form that he's in now, have got on at the Giro? How would Tadej Pogacar have done at the Giro? There's no, you can't really sort of extrapolate from these performances how they would get on in other races at all. There isn't really a good framework. For all that they had good times up the Stelvio, there can be all kinds of reasons for that too, and the conditions, the racing beforehand, state of freshness, and so on. So it's very hard to make these comparisons, isn't it? I guess the Giro is the Giro, and there's a question mark over the 84 race because the stages were shortened. There was a question about the route favouring Francesco Moser, who was up against Laura Fino, and there are still to this day questions about whether he was a worthy winner of that race. And I don't think certainly won't be the case with this Giro. There were no stages that were lost, you know, which was a fear at one point. It was a proper Giro, and so that also is in, you know, that's a point in its favour, I suppose.
And also, I think the fact that, I mean, I know Vincenzo Nibali is now a veteran rider, isn't he? But a former champion in the Giro and the Tour de France and the Vuelta. And, he, you know, he was saying this is a hard race. Now, of course, his legs are getting older and it must be very difficult, I imagine. Obviously, don't know, but I imagine as riders, they still have the muscle memory of what it was like to be first and second in the mountain stages rather than in the second or third group. And so, but the fact that Nibali was still thought of as a live threat going into that final week, even though the time gap was already reasonable, I think that's another point in its favour. But yeah, I think probably without wanting to get a splintery backside, I would say time will very much tell on that.
Well, listen, we should wrap things up for tonight. Big day tomorrow at the Vuelta, and Ian will be joining us again. Another listener got in touch, Andy Jefferson. Those curious about Preston Bus Station, or the Bussy as it's known, might like this miniature laser etched in concrete, and he's posted a picture of this on our Facebook page or in our Facebook chat group, discussion group. Cycling related fact, he says, when my son raced BMX with Preston Pirates, his coach would run winter evening training sessions on one of the upper floors of the car park. So there we go. Wow. More Preston bus station facts. And the reason for that, of course, is because Hugh Carthy's from Preston. And if you haven't yet listened to his interview with Mitch Docker, do so, Life in the Peloton. Lionel, can you clear something up for us? In that episode, Mitch said that the next episode would be the last one. He did mean of this season, didn't he?
He did mean of the season. We haven't signed a contract, we haven't done the deal yet, but we're in talks, and it's looking good that we will extend with Mitch Docker and Life in the Peloton next year. But I don't want to, unless he changed his mind in the last few days.
Yeah, one or two people have asked. Certainly he's not, the one in 2 weeks is not intended to be the last one ever by any stretch.
No.
So be reassured. No. A reminder
Richard, I mean, just the Preston bus station has grown a life of its own on the podcast. I'm wondering how long before we're 3D printing little replica models of Preston bus station for friends of the podcast. Maybe we could do that.
I'm already doing that, Lionel. I've got my 3D printer here. I'm running them off. But a reminder as well that next week we'll be doing, our episode will be a press conference episode. If you have a question for me, Lionel, Daniel, Ian, Lizzie, or Francois, please email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Send us an audio file. We've had quite a few already, so thank you for those. And, we'll be answering them next week. And we'll be joining, you'll be joining us again tomorrow, Ian. Hope things are good in the US. We're all watching with interest what's happening there. To make an awkward parallel, when I was contemplating Roglic winning the Vuelta today, I thought back to him at the Tour de France, and when he was at La Planche des Belles Filles, he'd lost the Tour unexpectedly, and the grace and dignity with which he handled that and went immediately to congratulate Pogacar struck me as an interesting moment given the way that your president is at the moment. But anyway, that's enough of the politics. Apologies for anyone out there who has a different view. If Rog wants to offer a few tips about losing gracefully, there you are.
You mean he didn't say, but this morning I was winning and now this evening I'm not winning. This is outrageous.
Stop the count. Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. Sorry, we're going to get complaints. I apologise. But
take it all back,
Richard. I take it back. Anyway, thanks very much, Ian. Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich.